Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, we highlight the 2020 February edition of Retinal Physician. This is available in print and for free online at retinalphysician.com. And we're doing something a little different. In the past, what we had done was have correspondents come on, read the articles, and we use them as a jumping point up for discussion. For this issue, what we've done is we've actually asked three of the authors to come on and discuss with them. And actually, all three of them had previously been on the program. First, Dr. Nina Barakal and I discuss subretinal gene therapy and some tips for surgery, especially in light of the FDA-approved gene therapy for the eyes, Luxturna, Voretigene, and Parvovec. Next, Dr. Ali Khan, who wrote an article with Dr. Alan Ho about different routes of gene therapy delivery, especially in age-related macular degeneration, comes to discuss that. And we finish with Dr. Arshad Khanani, who also was editor of this edition, and we discuss the trials that are available looking at gene therapy and the different routes that companies are taking to look at these options. Remember that all of our contributors are going to have a list of financial disclosures in the episode description. You can also claim CME credits for this and many other episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description. That will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. We are now happy to be joined by Dr. Nina Barakal. Dr. Barakal is professor of clinical ophthalmology at the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute, where she is also the head of the pediatric retina service. And she was the author of this article in this month's edition of Retinal Physician. The title of the article was Surgical Techniques for Retinal Gene Therapy Delivery, subtitled Subretinal Injection Prevails, Other Methods Being Explored. And Dr. Kenneth Fan was the other author in this paper. Dr. Fan, third-year resident, rising fellow here at Bascom Palmer. Dr. Barakal, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jay.
So just for brief, I'm going to just summarize this for people who want to read the article. It is available online at the website. But what you guys talked about was just the different routes that have been kind of discussed for delivering gene therapy, including intravitreal and subretinal routes. And then you talk a little bit about the only FDA-approved gene therapy currently, Luxturna or Voretigene and Parvovec. And that's a subretinal injection during vitrectomy. You kind of go through some pearls and some tips. So if you do have somebody that you're trying to teach how to do gene therapy, you're trying to explain going into surgery kind of the biggest pearls, what are the things you would want them to capture? What sort of things do you tell your fellows when they watch these procedures?
Yes. Well, I have to say that, you know, in kids and in adults, the most important thing, you know, to start with is the removal of the hyoid. And in these cases, surprisingly so, it's easier to remove than in a normal, you know, child with a foreign vitreous. So I like to stain it to be sure that I remove it completely, especially in the area that I'm interested in. And that said, you know, please do check the periphery, you know, to be sure that you're not creating any holes or tears in these kids in the far periphery. But once you accomplish that, then the most important thing in my mind is to get into the subretinal space without creating a problem, you know, no bleeding, no pressing too hard. And for me, the technique that has worked the best is using a flat contact lens, because I think that gives you the best 3D depth perception to the image. If you're lucky enough to have the 3D system, I think the 3D system works great. But if you have your conventional microscope, I think a flat contact lens is the best thing. And, you know, we use the subretinal cannula from MET1, and that I like to bevel it. I've tried to use it straight with the blunt tip, but I think the beveling works better, at least in my hands. And I use the automated MET1 microinjector connected to the vitrectomy machine, and that to me, a direct injection of the vector in the subretinal space works the best.
And what infusion pressure do you set on the machine typically?
Well, it all depends which machine you use. If you're using, most people use Constellation, that's 16 millimeters approximately of mercury. If you use the DORC, it has a different setting, so I think I go up to 1.5 to 2.5. in the injection pressure.
Perfect. And then for this, I mean, in the past for TPA, some people would do a pre-bleb, for example, of BSS. Has that been evaluated with gene therapy, or do you normally just go straight with the agent into the subretinal space?
You know, some people like to do the pre-bleb. I prefer to go straight just because you're reducing the amount of times that you're going into the bleb and in and out of the eye. So, you know, I'm in many ways a minimalist, so I like the least amount of instruments and the least amount of in and out of the eye. So for me, I think going straight with the microinjector works great.
How big a bleb do you make, and then what does the rest of the surgery look like?
Yes, one of the important things is that, you know, as you're injecting the bleb, one of the things is that the bleb is going to go wherever it wants to go. And sometimes it just won't spread in diameter, so it just goes up in axial height. So you don't want that, because if you have the fovea, you can create thinness of the fovea, and you can create a macular hole. So in those cases, it's better to create two blebs than create a really high and thin one.
And then maybe you haven't encountered it, but for surgeons who have created a macular hole, then what would be kind of the next step? Like, what do you imagine you would do then?
Well, I think in those cases, you know, you would just do your air fluid exchange. I think you would use probably something, you know, a little longer lasting than air. Right now we're switching to air so that we remove any of the vector that goes in the pre-retinal space to reduce the amount of inflammation. But I guess in those cases, using maybe SF6, something a little bit longer lasting, I think that would work.
And then, so in terms of follow-up, I mean, we'll talk a little bit more. So what you see going forward, I mean, between intravitreal and subretinal techniques, obviously intravitreal would be more convenient for patients, and there's different challenges in terms of delivering the drug. But let's say we are going forward and we are going to be doing more subretinal surgery going forward in the future. What sort of unmet needs do you see surgically? So surgically, in terms of techniques or instruments or things that would make this easier, what sort of things could be developed to kind of help us if let's say we're doing more subretinal surgery for AMD, for example, or for conditions that are more common than LCA?
Well, you know, one of the biggest, you know, voids that we have is, you know, the lenses that we use in, you know, with the resight. And I believe that we're going to be doing gene therapy in younger and younger patients for the inherited disorders. I think we're going to be doing gene therapy for a lot of diseases earlier on, even for macular degeneration, not as an older patient, but younger. And for the kids, I will tell you that I still don't have a great lens that I can use, that I can manipulate, you know, all the instruments in eyes of smaller kids. So I think that that's something that, you know, industry has to work on, because that for sure is an unmet need. But I think
you're
we can
about
still
a,
have...
a contact lens or a non-contact lens for kids?
No, a non-contact lens. A non-contact lens for kids. You know, if you think about it, when you have a small eye, the instruments have to go more vertically in so that you don't touch the lens. And with the lenses that we have right now, the diameter is too wide, so they're always bumping into the lens, so you have no mobility of the eye. So in you know, for those eyes, we definitely need a different kind of lens. But, you know, I think 3D systems are going to be great for gene therapy, especially for the injections in the subretinal space. I was able to do one of my cases in a 3D system, and the ease of doing that surgery with 3D was great. I think that having, you know, that system with what we have presently will make, you know, subretinal injections, you know, very quick and very easy.
Well, and plus if you can incorporate somehow intraop OCT on that heads-up display, that would go a long ways for making it easier.
Yeah, and remember when I used the Envision, they had the OCT on the screen. So they had integrated it to my 3D screen, so it was great. You know, so I was able to see, you know, the OCT as I'm doing it and 3D at the same time, but not superimposed, which is great because then you can see it, you know, to the side of your image. And I think that's going to change everything. If we're really going to be doing subretinal injections, you know, there's that idea now that we might go into the suprachoroidal space. And I think that opens the door to a lot of interesting techniques in the future.
Dr. Bierkel, thanks so much for your time and for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jay. A pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm now joined by Dr. M. Ali Khan, who was the article for one of the articles in this Retinal Physician February issue. The title of his article was "The Eye as a Biofactory." He wrote this with Dr. Alan Ho, his colleague at Wills Eye Hospital Mid-Atlantic Retina. The subtitle was "The Next Phase of Gene Therapy." Ali, people can obviously go and read this article. It's available online at retinalphysician.com. Quick 2-minute summary of what you guys wrote about and talked about.
Yeah, so this is for an episode of Retinal Physician that's focusing on gene therapy, so a variety of different topics. So what myself and Dr. Ho were asked to write about were how gene therapy applies to more multifactorial conditions like AMD and diabetic retinopathy, as opposed to what we're used to hearing about, like inherited retinal diseases, as is the case with, you know, RPE65 retinal dystrophy, which Luxturna from Spark Therapeutics was approved for. So the article, you know, basically summarizes the kind of the difference between an inherited retinal disease and why that the early gene therapy trials focused on those conditions, because, you know, they're orphan diseases, they can get FDA approval faster, and there's a very precise gene that can be targeted for gene therapy, and how that differs from conditions like AMD and DME, where we're actually not looking to make a protein that the cells, you know, typically make, in this case, say, anti-VEGF, and how you would maybe go about things a little bit differently, meaning with, you know, the window of opportunity for treating inherited retinal disease may be in a very young age, while for things like AMD and DME, diabetic retinopathy, we have obviously more time. And the challenges related to that, how do we assess if there's a steady of the drug being produced, and exactly what is the best, you know, gene therapy method, delivery being subretinal via a parsynergectomy and transretinal approach or suprachoroidal approach. And the different trials that are currently indexed on clinicaltrials.gov that are looking to employ gene therapy for factorial conditions like AMD in particular. So it was from a basic article explaining gene therapy, why targeting conditions like AMD and diabetic retinopathy are different than, say, an inherited retinal disease, some of the challenges that we're trying to work out to get it to a place where it's FDA approved and available to the general public.
Great summary. And you know, just a couple follow-up questions on this topic, very hot topic. I think, first of all, the devil advocate question. So if this isn't going to work, what are kind of the biggest challenges you foresee, regardless of route of administration, for gene therapy?
So question being, you know, why would gene therapy work?
So here, let's say negatively, like let's say they do REGENXBIO or Adverum, one of these companies. Why would this fail? Like, what kind of things are we thinking are going to fail? We have a good model with Luxturna for labors in terms of gene therapy working. But just for people who are listening, we're like, oh, this sounds great. We're definitely going to be doing gene therapy in 5 years. What are kind of the cautions? Well, maybe this may take a little longer. Or what could be a barrier to this hitting the market?
Yeah, so I think one thing is surgical technique. So yeah, you might have a perfect vector and gene therapy product, but if you do not get it in the right place or in the right way, it won't work. So that's why there is still a lot of focus right now on method of delivery, whether, you know, suprachoroidal approach without a parsynergectomy vitrectomy versus a parsynergectomy and transretinal approach is still the best way. That's still up for debate. Second is the vectors themselves. So, you know, you're limited to what you can put in a gene therapy product based on the capacity of the vector. And say your delivery goes perfect, but can you ensure that enough of your gene therapy products are actually getting into cells and then producing your protein of interest? That remains to be seen. You know, is there, you know, you cannot necessarily identify the cells that have been successfully transfected with your gene therapy product and quantify the number of gene therapy related proteins produced by an individual cell. So we're not at that point yet. So how do you assess a steady state of a drug in an individual patient over the course of a long period of time still remains to be seen. And are there patient factors that will determine some people, the product working better than others, still remains to be seen. So I think the concept of getting genetic material into somebody's cell and have it replicate to produce a protein makes sense, but will it actually work? I think depends on, you know, that still remains to be seen. That's why this is still phase 1-2 at this point.
And then I think the most common question I'll get from a patient, for example, or a colleague who's not a retinal specialist, is like, okay, this is great. What's the realistic time to market?
So, you know, there's, I think, three or four different. So Adverum, Hemera Biosciences, Regenxbio Bio currently have a phase 1-2 study currently, and Gyroscope Therapeutics and also Hemera Biosciences have a phase 1-2 for dry AMD, you know, with a complement regulatory protein as the focus rather than an anti-VEGF molecule. So the time to market is still going to be a while because it has not passed through phase 1 and phase 2. So it took probably 2 years in phase 1 and phase 2 before moving on to, say, phase 3, which would be an additional few years. So I think in the next 5 years would be kind of the fastest timeline here. But again, it all depends on if it works. Now, we've had gene therapy trials, you know, the Avalanche Technologies trials and some others that, you know, did not progress. And I think there was a reason for that. So those are all things that the upcoming trials are trying to address, particularly being the vector, the protein of interest, and the method of delivery.
It's so cool to think about, right? Because I think that I feel like there's going to be an era in 10, 15, or 20 years where we're telling our residents and fellows about a day when we used to inject patients monthly. And maybe sure there's going to be non-responders. There's always a small percentage of non-responders. Even to anti-VEGF, currently there's non-responders. But I feel like we're going to really reduce the treatment burden on a local scale and a national scale, international scale, in really a revolutionary way. The final thing, I guess, if we're extrapolating, how early are we going to be treating patients if this is successful? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it'll depend on the disease. So If we can predict which patients are going to go from early and intermediate dry AMD to advanced atrophic with geographic atrophy, I think we're going to be treating those patients with some type of gene therapy if it proves that the complement regulatory proteins are effective much earlier at a younger age. So I think prediction is still going to be a big part of it. And then also for, you know, the quote unquote classic AMD patients, I think, you know, whenever you would have started an AMD, what AMD injection, you would probably consider gene therapy at that point. I think really just going to be a matter of if it does work, how are you going to employ this at scale and at what cost? Because these are going to be surgical procedures. Can you imagine how many patients are going to...
The only market model for gene therapy is Luxturna, which is $425,000 an eye. Right? Like but that's a different, that's been deemed cost effective because you're taking people in the early years of life. And so if you extrapolate over the years of life, it's actually published on this, it's cost effective. I would hate to see cost effectiveness should not be our number one consideration when this is something that will drastically improve the quality of life of an age group that is losing vision. But it'd be interesting to see how this is priced because if it's priced at that same point, it's just not going to be feasible given the burden of age-related macular degeneration. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd be curious, especially like you said, if it's a surgical intervention, then the question, it's obviously a little riskier than if it's an intravitreal injection, weighing non-monetary costs, just risks in terms of costs.
All right. So if it's as cost-effective as doing ongoing monthly intravitreal injections, I don't know how you proceed from there. So, you know, if the answer is it's going to be just as effective as a treatment, you know, it's one anti-VEGF comparing to another, you are going to get down to cost and scale. And I think that's going to be the next kind of interesting phase of this. So this article was kind of talking, you know, you brought up a great point. Inherited retinal diseases, like in the case of the Luxturna, there's not really like an argument here. There was no treatment for it. So now we have something and there's not that many patients. So like as an overall cost of your system, it's not, you know, an overly burdensome topic. And I don't think anyone's going to argue against helping restore vision to young kids who otherwise would certainly lose it. But conditions like AMD and diabetic retinopathy, there's going to be some discussion there. So once we get to, you know, obviously you got to pass the clinical trial phase to get to that point. But I think once we get to that point, it'll be even more of a, it'll be a regulatory and cost-effectiveness discussion more than anything.
Perfect. Dr. Khan, thanks for your time. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Jake.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Arshav Khanani, who is the founder and a retina specialist at Sierra Eye Associates in Reno, Nevada, and also clinical associate professor at University of Nevada, Reno. Dr. Kanani was the author of one of the articles and a co-editor for this issue of Retinal Physician in February 2020. And the title of his article was Gene Therapy for Neovascular AMD, subtitle An Update of Ongoing Clinical Trials. He wrote this with Fawaz Siddiqui and Amar Aziz, were his co-authors. So again, this article is available online at retinalphysician.com. You can go ahead and read it. We're not going to go through all of the details, but Arshad, just for the listeners, just give them like a 1 or 2 minute summary of what you talked about in this article and what we have right now in terms of gene therapy for wet AMD.
Jay, thank you for having me review my article. So basically, as you know, we are all busy in our clinics, and number of patients are increasing on a daily basis, and so our number of injections, and we all hit a point where we can't take any more patients or patients get burned out. And we know the real world data that patients actually don't maintain the vision. They actually lose vision over time. And we also confirmed that in our recently published Sierra AMD study in ophthalmology retina. So I think gene therapy is really a shift in paradigm to treat these patients with neovascular AMD. And our article really overviews, what we have currently ongoing. We are lucky to be part of both RGX-314 and ADVM-022 trials. As you know, RGX-314 is a subretinal gene therapy that's done in the OR, and the AAV8 vector actually takes a gene for monoclonal antibody Fab similar to ranibizumab and delivers it, and your cells start producing this antibody. And basically, you have a factory in the eye, and you are controlling your vascular AMD with this gene therapy. ADVM-022 is a 7M8 vector that takes the gene for aflibercept. The main difference is it's an intravitreal injection. But again, you are treating these patients in your office, delivering the gene for aflibercept. Your cells start producing aflibercept, then your disease gets controlled. And the idea is that hopefully both of these treatments, we are hitting a level where we are eliminating the need for injections completely or decreasing the number of injections. And then we talk a little bit about the Humira HMR-59, which is another approach, but it's a unique approach. It's not secreting anti-VEGF. It's actually designed to block MAC, membrane attack complex, which is the final step of the complement cascade. And basically trying with gene therapy to decrease the number of injections in these patients. And the good news is that the early data from all of these treatments seem to be very positive.
Yeah, and I think that patients with wet AMD have come a long way. 15 years ago, there was no anti-VEGF until 2005, 2004, 2005. And now it's great. Most patients do respond to therapy, can maintain or gain vision with therapy. But I think the next burden, like you mentioned, is the burden of injection and the frequency. So a lot of patients are, especially ones who are well-read or listening or providers, are really interested in this idea of durable therapy or quote-unquote curative therapy potentially with gene therapy. So before we talk about what the implications of that would be, just what do you think in terms of what are kind of going to be the biggest barriers or potential issues with these sort of therapies? And then what do you project in terms of timeline? Like, even if everything goes smoothly, how soon would these be available in the market?
So I think whenever you have a new treatment, I think we have learned that in the past that we have to see the long-term efficacy and safety of these treatments. Yes, the early data is very positive in terms of controlling the disease. Like if you look at the cohort 5 in RGX-314 trial, 75% of patients didn't require any rescue injections. And those rescue injections are pretty liberal criteria. You could receive rescue even if you have stable fluid at time or persistent fluid. And then you look at Adverum's ADVM-022 data where you have zero rescue injections and these patients have gone, more than 6 months in the cohort 1, and you still have zero injections. So I think the initial data is looking very positive, but long-term safety and efficacy needs to pan out. When you look at RGX-314, it is a surgical procedure. And so we need to, you know, obviously evaluate risk and benefits of it. It's very safe based on the data so far. And we're all used to doing subretinal TPA injection. It's pretty similar to that. But obviously, we have to keep that in mind. And that's why, you know, they're moving forward with suprachoroidal treatment in clinic to evaluate the efficacy and safety of that. And then, you know, with VM-022, you have some information that we learned about from the trial. The good news is that, you know, the inflammation has been controlled well with the topical steroids. So I think going forward, we need to learn about the safety and long-term effects in the eye. You know, does continuous anti-VEGF secretion, does it have any ocular or systemic adverse events? The good news is, so far, we have not seen any. So we are hoping that these programs continue to move forward. The barriers will be obviously, you know, going to the OR or cost and other things that will come into the play. But I think the science is looking really, really good. In terms of, you know, when it's going to be available, so I think the programs are moving forward. RGX-314 phase 2B trial will start this year. ADVM-022, they're currently recruiting cohort 3 and 4 for their phase 1. So I'm thinking close to probably 5 to 6 years down the road, if everything pans out, we should be lucky to have this treatment for our patients.
And then when that happens, I think the big question we don't know the answer to is, how early are we going to be starting treatments in these patients?
Well, based on my experience, I think both trials, and we are not part of the HMR-59 trials, so I can't speak much about that, but for RGX-314 and for ADVM-022, I mean, in the trials, these were heavily pretreated patients, right? Because if you're enrolling in phase 1, phase 2, these patients have a high burden and they're tired of injections. But I think the idea would be that, you know, for RGX-314, you get a few ranibizumab injections, and if you respond well, you should be a candidate for the gene therapy. And for ADVM-022, if you respond to aflibercept, then you should be a candidate. I mean, what I've seen personally is everybody, as you mentioned earlier, Jay, that all the patients are super interested in sustained delivery or a durable or an essentially curing treatment. So I think patients are going to be really motivated to do this, and physicians are going to be motivated because we want to do the right thing for the patients. But at the same time, you know, the pricing and insurance and other factors that play into providing a treatment, the cost, those are going to be, of course, the factors that may eventually decide how quickly we can give this treatment.
And I guess the last question, which we don't know the answer to, because there's really no model to compare, is how this will be priced and what the market forces will dictate. Because the only model we have for FDA-approved gene therapy is Luxturna, voretigene, which is $425,000 a dose, but a little bit of a different situation. This is for patients who have zero existing treatment, who are young, who have a whole lifetime of vision ahead of them. So they've done some cost effectiveness data, and it's been shown to be cost effective, which is not surprising, taking someone who could be legally blind and making them functional changes, not only the trajectory of their life, but even from a purely economic perspective, makes a lot of sense. But for AMD, it's interesting because we have existing therapy that works, and we're going to have more and more options that are also sustained release. How this is priced may determine kind of access to this treatment as well, right?
No, I totally agree with you. I think it was groundbreaking to get Luxturna's approval. We are so lucky that we have an FDA-approved gene therapy. But totally different, right? This is the number one cause of blindness in patients, elderly patients in this country. We have known treatment, as you said, and we're going to have longer-acting agents, and we're also going to have, hopefully, port delivery system, which is also sustained delivery, KSI-301, GB-102, faricimab. I mean, as you know, the market is so crowded. You and I are both involved with all these other things that are happening. But I think gene therapy shifts the paradigm to a really high level. I think it changes, you know, the disease to essentially, you know, curable disease in most patients. It won't be 100% of the patients because every patient is different. But I think the value for gene therapy is totally different. Getting down clinic visits, getting down injection visits, caretaker burden, burden for the patients. I mean, so I think all of those should be kept in mind. But yeah, I mean, I don't expect it to be $500,000 or $250,000. I think it will be reasonable to price, let's say 5 years worth of treatment with anti-VEGF for 10 year work. So maybe 50 to 100,000 probably would be reasonable. And I think the payers may see that value. But, at the end of the day, you and I both have to fight for our patients and be pushing the science to get the best treatment options for them. So I think it's really a great step in the right direction.
Well, Arshad, I really appreciate you coming on to discuss this, and obviously a very hot topic and something we're all going to be paying a lot of attention to in our meetings and our press releases and over the next couple of years. So thank you for co-editing this issue. Thank you for writing this article, and thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you, Jay. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Take care.
Thank you.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can find all 212 episodes, yes, 212 episodes on our website. They're sorted by category, easy to search, and great to go back through the archive. You can subscribe for the latest episodes as they come out each week on our website by clicking on the subscribe link and entering your email address. You can also contact us on the website by emailing us directly or clicking on the button on the website. We're on Twitter and on Facebook. At Retina Podcast is our Twitter handle. And remember, you can find us in the Apple Store, Android Store on your mobile device. That's the way I subscribe to keep up with the episodes so I know when they come out. And we appreciate everyone who's left positive reviews in the Apple and Android stores. Many thanks to Dr. Barakal, Dr. Khan, and Dr. Kanani for joining me for this podcast. Thanks to Jen Ford and the team at Pentavision for providing the articles in advance. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venicasa, who prepared this episode and the accompanying social media. And listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.